Hello, brand manager. How are you? Welcome to your first Q&A session with your humble virtual marketing professor. How are you going? We're at the end of week two. Hopefully things are progressing. You're getting into that rhythm we spoke about. And it's all starting, just starting to hang together. Before I get on to, we've got a lovely bunch of questions. Before I get into the questions, let me just go through kind of the rules of engagement for Q&As. So they happen every second week. As you can see, all you do is jump on the tile next to the end of the second module, click on the box and enter your questions. Your deadline is the end of business on Thursday, and then I get up now, Friday, and record the answers, answering every question. In terms of questions, you can ask anything about any piece of content. We'd like you to focus on the two modules we've just covered, but you don't have to if you're behind or something else is going on. Be conscious everyone's watching. So if you're going to ask a question which is, you know, to some degree slightly internal about your company or your brand, just be conscious that, you know, others are watching. So you might want to keep, you know, the name of the company out of it. It's always a good idea. What else do I need to tell you? We have a, I pick at the end a, I do a couple of things. So I pick a question of the week, and that person gets, I think it's like $200 of vouchers, some kind of prize. It's cool. And then often I'll get questions about stuff and I'll answer the question, but I'll follow up later with extra material. And I do that in our LinkedIn group on Monday. Okay. So you'll see me occasionally making notes of stuff, and I'll basically have, you know, a follow up set of links for you by Monday. You can, you know, as I've tried to explain, it's not live for good reason, and so you don't have to immediately on a Friday watch this. Okay, you can access it whenever you want. It'll stay for the whole module, for the whole course. And also, there's the podcast version that, as a, you know, as a proof point of my general attractiveness, 70% of our class prefer to listen to this rather than watch this beautiful face at 6 a.m. in the morning presented to you, which I understand. So you can do it in either format. Yeah. The final thing which confuses some people is if you look up there into your website. That you're currently accessing this on, you'll see that in the web address, it either says Cohort A or Cohort B. Don't worry about that. All it means is we've got a very big class, which is a good thing. And I like these Q&As to be no more than an hour. And so the class this time is so big that if I was to just do a single Q&A, it would be probably 2.5 hours long. So I'm just breaking you into two random groups. The questions are always very similar. And therefore, there'll be two questions of the week, as you'll see. But that just enables the session to be an hour long, which I feel is enough. Yeah. But it's totally arbitrary. If you're in cohort B, which I think, yeah, you lot are, it's not that you're like the dumb ones, you know, it's just arbitrary. I swear we shouldn't have called it A and B. We should have called it, you know, fantastic and wonderful or something. But you get the idea. You can ask multiple questions. Try two things. Don't ask too many questions. Don't pepper me with questions. We've got, you know, lots of people, but I want to answer the questions you have. And keep the questions tight if you can. Again, I don't want it to be too simplistic. Try not to give me, you know, here's 17 questions in a 400-word paragraph. I will answer them, but everyone else, not me, will get annoyed with you. Otherwise, that's it. I think we've got about an hour of material today. I'm in Sydney. I've got my neighbour's dog. Normally, I've got my own dogs. I'm in Tasmania, but I'm in our little place in Sydney, and my neighbour has gone camping and has left me with Stella the poodle, a dog to which I have very little knowledge of. But we've had a nice night together, and she now seems to love me. So she's at my feet purring. She's like a cat. It's not like a real dog. In Tasmania, I have real dogs that look like wolves and like eat rabbits and stuff. This is kind of not really like a dog at all. It's more like a parrot or a small bunny, you know. But she seems to like me. And what my neighbors don't know is that I'm the Brad Pitt of the canine world. Most of my class would rather listen to me on a podcast. But dogs, and I was born in the year of the dog, dogs love me. Like, they won't be able to get their dog back. Like, wait and see. Yeah. Dogs just love me. It's my one superpower. I have dog magnetism. If I was like a Doberman Pinscher, I'd be like, can't say that, but you know, I'd be popular. Anyway, let's get on to the questions quicker, better than later. We're kicking off with Sarah. Oh, and by the way, I order them by popularity. Sarah's question is the most popular, but we're going to cover them all anyway. So Sarah says, how is brand salience measured? It's measured, Sarah, basically with a different cue than brand awareness is. So if you look at how we normally do it, most people are familiar with brand awareness, right? You cue people with the category. When you think about, what's a good one? Computers. When you think about laptops, which brands come to mind, right? The point that Ehrenberg Bass make is that's kind of a weirdly artificial category cue, because people don't go, I need a laptop. That's not how it begins from a market-oriented point of view. Consumers begin with, I'm starting an online course and I need a computer that I can work on planes, right? And so what they tend to do is they step back and work out, first of all, what are these category entry points? So what are the 4, 5, 6, 7 main category entry points that lead someone to buy a laptop? And they do that through qualitative research. Then they go back and say, for the following, you know, needs, what products or services come to mind? And there's a couple of advantages to that, right? You get a relative balance now of a more market-oriented sense of brand coming to mind. And that, you know, that definition of competition that we talked about, which is often flawed by the fact that it stays within category, when in reality the consumer is crossing categories for potential solutions, is also taken care of. So that's the main measure to do it. If you look, Jenny, it's kind of a weird world with Ehrenberg Bass. They sort of like go, you must reference our work. But at the same time, a lot of it is kind of trademark Ehrenberg Bass, you have to be a member of the center. It's kind of a weird thing, which I sort of understand. But if you have a look for Jenny Roman, you're giving a few talks in various places, you'll see that method discussed in a little bit more. But broadly speaking, identify category entry points, then measure which brands come up when queued with category entry points, gives you a salience result. And it's a good method. It's a good method. Angelo. Hi, Mark. On the subject of branding and commodification, I've been given the chance to work in an emerging market and a developed market where branding dynamics are very different. In more developed markets like Australia, I've witnessed the dominant retailers require all brands to pay to play via heavy in-store promotions. Yeah, Oz is very, very, even more so than the UK or America. The two big retailers demand pay to play, yeah. Which, coming from the lecture, is one of the key factors to commodify a brand. Heavy promotions such as this take its toll on overall brand budget and most of the time make it difficult to maintain a healthy share of market, share of voice split, given P&L targets you have to maintain. In this scenario, I'm keen to understand how to maintain branding brand equity if the dynamics of frequent mandatory sales price promotions outweigh an effectively lower brand building budget. I feel it would be difficult to maintain momentum, for example, if it is just my brand out of 10 brands who is not engaging in this activity. Sometimes it is easier to brand build in emerging markets where retailers do not have as much influence on your sales turnover rate versus developed markets. Would appreciate your thoughts. Yeah, look, yes and no. I mean, I feel your pain. It is tricky. And it's true that, you know, in many cases you have to run promotions because your retailers pretty much demand it. You don't have to do it, of course, but you have to do it. I think the first thing is, when I'm talking about promotions, I'm talking about two things. I'm talking about the brand kind of doing it because they want to do it, first of all. And second, I talk about the brand doing it because and basically acquiescing to the retailer without trying to find some other non-price way to make everybody happy. Now, I'm not being naive. That's often hard. But you should always try, Angelo, to say, okay, we need some kind of promotion that you're going to be happy with. Do we have to play the price game? Can we just try and have a discussion around what else we might be able to do with you that would give you something special, but will avoid us having to play the price game. And if that doesn't work, and it often doesn't, then you've still got to maintain this, what's the right word, perspective, that we have to spend X amount of money on price-based promotions, which we do. As a result of that, not only should that money not come out of our remaining communications budget, we're going to need to increase the comms budget to make up for the fact that a lot of the money is going to promotions, and that promotions is actually having a negative impact on the brand. That's the true cost of it, right? That if we're going to be running these shredding price promotions here, we need to be doing something over here to offset it. Now, that goes down, as you can imagine, incredibly badly in the organization, but doesn't stop it from being true. Having said all of that, let's not shit all over the retailers, right? Yes, they're big. Yes, they're challenging. Yes, they expect certain things. But what they give us is that physical distribution that, you know, you talk romantically about these developing markets. That's true. They're not going to go after you on as much discount activity, but they aren't as concentrated. They are as logistically advanced. They aren't going to give you 92% of the population immediately overnight. You know what I mean? So there are advantages to the big retailers that we shouldn't forget about. Also disadvantages too. Marty Kane. Hey, Marty. Hi, Mark. Great first module. With regards to the financial brand equity section, where you talk about Interbrand's calculation of brand equity, you explain how Interbrand attribute a percentage of the brand earnings to the impact of the brand. Is there a methodology Interbrand used to calculate brand impact, or is that simply marketing activity in a mix of awareness consideration metrics? Thanks a million, Marty. And Chris jumps in and mentions something which I like it when you do that, but I won't read those out. And Chris makes a very good point. So first of all, as Chris notes, if you have a look at David Haig's brand valuation methodology, he goes into that. If you really want to get into financial brand equity, one of the optional extras is David, who runs brand finance. He's a very old mate of mine. Breaks it down for you. But the answer to your question, Marty, is Interbrand has... So every company can work out the intangible contribution being made per brand in their portfolio. You know, it's an estimate. Even external companies can quickly work out how much money does each brand make, right? The two pieces that remain, though, in that calculation, which come down to, first of all, to your question, how much of that money is because of your brand and the rest just because you were there, etc. And then how safe is that proportion over time? Those are always going to be calculated differently by different firms. Interbrand have a quite convoluted, complex way of saying how much in a category is driven by brand, which, again, Brand Z from Kantar has a different approach. It's an assessment, though, and that's the secret sauce that each brand company will treasure. But it's a trait, you know, they'll tell you sort of how they do it, but not go into too much detail, because that's how they're getting more accurate. I find the Kantar approach to be, I think I explained in one of the columns, it's worth mentioning. For a long time, I gave all three companies, Brand Finance, Interbrand, and Brand Z, a whole bunch of shit, because they always came up with different values for everything. And a Swiss firm called Marketable said, "You're absolutely right. Why don't we help you show who's best? Because we can compare what they said the brands were worth with any example on the planet where a brand was acquired for a externally communicated amount of money. And we'll see how close they all got." And the answer was, yeah, Kantar, the Brand Z one, was by far the most accurate. It was still pretty inaccurate, but it was a lot closer than Brand Finance was or Interbrand was. So their secret sauce, which is based on a lot more data, I think is the best one, I have to say. Michaela. Hey, Michaela. In the second module, you outline the importance of diagnosis before forming a strategy. When performing research on your brand's position in market or top-of-mind awareness, is there a way to achieve this without a large survey? I saw in the slides an ethnography mentioned and was wondering if you could apply other common UX research methods to marketing to accommodate for lower budgets. What's your recommendation for this? Okay, so we will talk about it a lot. Well, that's what we're going to talk about in Module 3, Michaela. The short answer to your question is You can, as you'll see, a lot of the methods I'm going to talk about are either qual or secondary, and they won't cost you anything in terms of money if you go that way. But it leaves you short. You know, I don't say you have to do quantitative research for the sake of quant research. If you don't have quant research, things like populating the segment, or in your case, setting benchmarks for things like objectives, aren't going to be possible. So be aware of that. I'll post a link on Monday to a talk I gave called Small Marketing, which is about companies that are smaller with less budget. How do they do this? And I talk a little bit in that talk about research. So I'll post that. But my advice for the course is go through the course with a lot of money. Do the survey stuff. You're going to buy research next week for Moon, right? So enjoy having $500,000, okay? And then you can see at the end of the Moon journey, do you think you could have done this without the quant, or do you just have to do a real simple quant? The reason I work a lot with Tracksuit, and I have to declare, I think I own 0.4% of Tracksuit. The reason I work so much with Tracksuit is for about, and don't quote me, but for about 10, 15 grand, they'll do your quantitative research and tracking for the year pretty well, and therefore make it more accessible to smaller brands. We'll talk more about that down the track too. Chris, hi Mark. Refer to slide 35 of week one, A Tale of Two Halves. Admittedly, the first thing I'm off to do is read How Brands Grow and Keller's paper, but given two opposing views of can't both be right, are there examples where you see salience as more important? For example, is the salience light model more applicable to particular categories, stable brands, 50-year pedigrees? On the other hand, is salience only important for a growth strategy? I'd like to know where you sit on the spectrum between the two. I also had consultants that say it depends. Yeah, it isn't category specific. That's the first thing I can tell you. And I know Marcos is suggesting it here, but it isn't. There's a sense in the old world that high involvement stuff was more about awareness and low involvement stuff was more about salience. I think now we've seen the B2B Institute, for example, at LinkedIn have showed us conclusively that you can use salience even in B2B. And a brand that comes to mind is still a very strong advantage even in higher involvement categories. I do think it just comes down not to it depends, but a matter of choice. Yeah. The thing about using a salience model is it's a more complex way of measuring it. But then if you think about a funnel built on salience, it pretty much takes the whole top of funnel, because salience doesn't just replace awareness. It pretty much gets rid of consideration as well. And so it can be, if you go down that route, that you've got a much more simplified funnel that just basically runs salience, purchase, repurchase sort of thing. I'm still a sucker, and it might just be because I'm old-fashioned. I still like having the salience stuff and the category entry point stuff is, for me, interesting, but I still like a funnel that runs through a flavor of one of the flavors of awareness and then into consideration. That's just what I'm used to. But there's no dictate. You know, the nice thing is you can fiddle around with both and see which one you prefer. But, I don't like the debate where, and, you know, Aaron Bogbass do this too much, in my opinion. You know, awareness is shit, salience is great, you know. Yeah, it comes back to this scientific stuff, you know. I don't think it's all that scientific. It's rigorous, and then you can make a choice what works best. And the shortest answer is you can measure both and then see what generates the most insight. Chris again, since Romeo and Sharp's seminal work, have any researchers tested the role of brand salience in buyer behavior? And if so, have any concrete measures for salience been highlighted? The article gives us a guiding framework, but doesn't give an answer for new brand managers to point towards when we want to trend salience or understand the effects of our brand building on cues and recall and hence buying situations. Yet there isn't any great omnibus, Chris, because there can't be, right? Like any of these metrics, and we'll get into this when we set objectives, you're looking at two things. The reference point is your salience a year ago, as measured in the same way, and the salience of your alternative brands that the consumer's considering that you've also measured. So that's what it looks at. There's certainly been evidence that it definitely does work and is a huge driver of business effects, preference, and sales, etc. No one doubts that. as is the case with awareness too, it's probably more important than anyone. The top of the funnel is certainly proving to be more important than most people thought in doing that stuff. But in terms of the actual kind of steer as to when is your salience good or bad, you need benchmark data. And we will talk about that in the course. Lorena, hi, Mark. On the topic of brand salience, could you elaborate a bit more on the difference between brand salience and brand consideration? Okay. It's an interesting question because normally people ask the difference between salience and awareness. And we've kind of explained that already. Consideration is useful. If we do awareness, then really we're just saying, does it come up at all, right? The salience school of thought would say, look, not only does it come to mind in buying situations, but that coming to mind also stands in for consideration. You wouldn't see, I think in any correct sense, a funnel that started with salience and then had consideration underneath it. Because salience in that school of thought is by definition embracing awareness right through consideration as well. Yeah. So I think it just simply replaces it, Lorena, in that case. And you can just jam them all together and call it salience and move on to, okay, the brand is salient. Is it the preferred one? Right. And you can move on from there. If you're going to have awareness, then usually something around a consideration becomes more important. And you're trying to, because think about what happens. If I've got a level of, we've got it in the course. MidiMBA, we did this work, right? We found that we've got pretty good awareness. I can't remember the exact number. Let's say 12% of British marketers are aware of MidiMBA, right, as a training option or development option. And something like 8% consider us, right? The drop-off is either they don't think they can do the course because it's overseas, they don't like me, and there was one other one, I forget what it was, right? The price, yeah? So that's why we lose a certain proportion from aware to consider. If you're going to do the salience school of thought, you know, when you think about developing yourself, which brands come to mind, the idea of salience is if it's coming to mind, it's definitely an option already, and it's sort of got over that consideration option, right? So that's why they kind of rub each other out. Guy Chapman, I'm really enjoying the course and looking forward to getting started on Moon. Yeah, a word on that before I get on with Guy's question. Try and find the time for Moon. I say that for a couple of reasons. It really finishes the course off. It's a shit ton of fun. The simulation's the most fun you'll have in marketing with your clothes on. Like, it's so good. If you're really busy, you don't have to. But you can do a really bad job of the Moon plan and still submit a dog shit plan. I'm not grading that, right? I'm looking at them. But the point of the simulation is I'm going to, you know, your grade here depends on how well you manage Moon, not how cool your brand plan is. So in that sense, you know, you just have a go, have a messy go and submit it and then really run the plan well in the sim. You'll get so much from it and it's not going to take a lot of time. Anyway, Guy says, a very basic question, having watched Module 2 video on the brand plan, is there any real difference between a brand plan and a marketing plan in your view? No, there isn't. I mean, there's no real difference in brand and marketing in many cases. You know, there's some lunatic course where they like, you know, you have to post the difference between brand and marketing. And it's always like, what are you doing? You know, it depends on the company. It depends on the brand architecture, which we'll see later. And it depends on the planning system. And so, you know, it's not possible for me to have a nice 2x2 that explains the difference because if you're in a company like, wherever I work, where it's been a branded house, like at McKinsey, for example, the marketing plan and the brand plan are one and the same. If you work in a company like LVMH, brand plans are very distinct from an overall marketing plan for a business category or business group. So it just depends, yeah? I think clarity on what we're developing comes from above, and you need that clarity first. But no, they're interchangeable, and every company does it their own way. And I think not looking for, you know, a simplistic what is this and what is that is the only advice I'd give you there. Sparta, hi, Mark. I've seen a lot of brands do limited product drops and intentionally create a sense of urgency for a consumer. I've always wondered, while it does create a lot of hype and it's a cool story, do you think from a brand equity perspective it can have a negative impact if the product is hardly attainable? Yeah, look, it's a great question, Sparta, and the answer is positioning, which we will get to. First of all, yeah, I like this approach. It certainly has worked for me in the past. particularly when I can target a particular segment and create that spillover. And also I can protect by choosing the right distributors to initially get the brand going. There's lots to be said for it. The downside is physical availability is hugely useful, and we sometimes make it harder to buy than we should. So you've got to balance those two things out. The way you make the call, though, is you look at your positioning and your strategy. You know, you're asking me a great tactical point about distribution, which can only be answered when I know who's my target, what's my position, what are my objectives. Then I can tell you whether to go selective or non-selective. Depends on the strategy of the brand. We'll get into that in a lot more detail. Cody, fantastic first module on readings. Well, steady on, Cody. You've already started. Thank you. I've seen the linear relationship between share of voice and share of market before, as well as the studies and HBR articles on those who lean into spending more during downturns, increasing SOV when many others pull back. Well, actually, not even that, Cody. Maintaining SOV when others pull back gives you that excess share of voice that gives you the boost when they're... Yeah, anyway, you get it. You know it. Being a successful strategy. Share of market is relatively simple to calculate, but do you have any guidance on how to calculate share of voice? I've seen some of you spend, but personally feel that it's too limited. It doesn't capture many other things such as earned media value. This is especially true with examples such as Tesla, who famously don't spend as much than others. Yeah, it's a common question. So the first answer is, if you're any decent size and you've got a media agency, get the media agency to give you the spend, and that is predictive enough. Yes, there's some alternatives like Tesla that don't fit the model, but 95% of brands do, and it's good enough. Even with so much digital spend now, which is very hard to estimate, I'm reassured by many people that the addressable spend is still highly predictive. It's interesting. The big challenges of how predictive share of excess share of voice is come back to not to do the accuracy of spend, but to do more and more marketers spend too much on performance and it messes it all up, you know. So no, the first one is, yeah, media spend via a media agency is predictive and will give you something. The second answer is, we are very close. I hate to get into it, but with artificial intelligence, we're very close to being able to do what you want to do, which is add that media spend with that quotient of estimatable, non-attributable stuff as well. I see that as a real line of sight. And, you know, I work with one particular large AI firm in America. One of the things we're training it on is an ability to give us a much better projection of excess share of voice instantly. And like most things with AI, it looks like it's doing it pretty well already. And remember that the issue isn't that, you know, how good is AI? The point is AI only has to be relatively shit to be a lot better than how we do it as humans. And I think an instantaneous excess share of voice chart calculated by from the learning models is not that far away. Cody again. I work with many companies who do a lot of M&A, and the question of whether to integrate the brand or maintain it as separate comes up a lot. I've studied Arca's brand relationship spectrum and often use it to illuminate the multiple brand options, but determining the best course of action is often a challenge. I know we're studying brand architecture later, so for simplicity's sake, I'm most interested in your take on a specific situation. Okay, I'll do it quick, Cody, but I will have answered this, I betcha, when we get to Module 8. But go on then, just for now. Assuming two brands merge and have similar relative revenue scale, products and target markets, what additional factors would you consider to decide whether to A, consolidate into one of the brands, or B, to maintain both? My supposition is that consolidation would yield improved focus, but the next question is, which factors would you look at to decide which one would be the prevailing brand and the other to be subsumed? If questions like this will be answered by Module 8, I'll wait. Wait! We'll cover it. Jesus. It's absolutely part of the syllabus, and I'll even show you how to do it. Just wait, okay? It's a brilliant question. And to be fair, Cody, for some reason, brand architecture, we get loads of questions on brand architecture. I just can't narratively put it at the start, or I would, right? But I swear to you I'll answer these questions, Cody. I swear to you. And if I don't, you can ask me again. Rebecca Adam. Hi, Mark. Great first session. I'm curious about your comment at the end of Module 1 about how brands are symbols of our identity. I entirely agree. But it got me thinking about how and if this is the case for professional services brands too. I work for a professional services brand in engineering in a country where many similar brands appear to have been quite commoditized, with little differentiation between them. I'd argue the whole engineering sector is in need of a brand makeover, in the same way accounts seem to have done for themselves. Accountants. I can see how a brand as an identity is relevant from a personal identity perspective, but what about when clients are making a choice or multiple people are weighing in on a choice about a services brand? In this case, an engineering company. How does brand become a reflection of identity? How important is it for the professional services space? And how do you have a good comparative example you could use in your response? Yours trying to grow a brand, increase market share. Yeah, look, I think the classic example is the ancient but still accurate truism that nobody ever got fired for hiring McKinsey. In those words, there is the answer to your question, yeah? I think there is a challenge in B2B, which is it is equally irrational as B2C, equally open to things like salience and perceptual shifts and behavioral economics. But then it becomes rationalizing later. So consumers are happy to admit, you know, I bought this coat because I just love it. Companies are able to then rationalize their decision to cover their asses, even though it was a highly irrational decision. But everything we talk about in terms of identity and security and the impact on perception plays out the B2B space. My short answer is have a look at the B2B Institute at LinkedIn. They've successfully shown that almost every concept in B2C applies just as well in B2B. And there's stuff there, if you dig through their material, it's brilliant, very empirical, that'll prove the point. But yeah, your fundamental assertion is correct. The buying committee of an engineering firm are massively swayed by the reputation and brand image of the consulting firms they do and don't work with, to the tune of, you know, price insensitivity, how they perceive the results. You know, it's as strong as buying a handbag or a car, you know? So yeah, it all works the same. And I'm sorry that's such a boring answer, but that's where I get to on B2B, B2C these days. I don't really buy into many differences, to be honest. Gonzalo. Considering that brand salience is more related to buying situations when compared to brand awareness, it is expected that brand salience should have a correlation or connection with volume share. Yep, absolutely. And it has been proven, Gonzalo. Salience in B2B, B2C is absolutely a significant correlate with purchase and preference. But so is brand awareness too. Ellie, I need to get used to saying brand equity. You do. Can you give a simple explanation of what brand equity is? What term should I not be using here when I should be using the term brand equity? And how do we measure brand equity? So we sort of did it in module one, but in a nutshell, brand equity is obviously the value of the brand. Yeah, and we can measure the value of the brand in the same brand in three different ways. We can measure it in employee terms, and that can be in sort of inputs, how they perceive an employer, or it can be in outputs, how much lower the salary can be for them to stay or get a job there. We can do it in financial terms, again, in terms of inputs, in terms of what are the, you know, the main drivers of financial brand equity, and then outputs in terms of balance sheet. But the main relevance for you, Ellie, is in consumer-based brand equity, which is, again, the inputs are the consumer is more aware of us, or we're more salient for the consumer, and the consumer thinks of us in a more positive way with more positive, more important brand associations. So some form of awareness and association, yeah? The stronger brands, I'm more aware of them, and I perceive them to be more of the things I want, yeah? That's what brand equity is in the consumer. And as a result of that, as we saw in module one, it transforms into price insensitivity, repeat purchase, volume growth, brand extension, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so look at module one. That's what brand equity is. How do you measure brand equity? Module three, next week. James Edwards, in your experience, what is the most effective way of justifying building a successful business case for successful investment in a brand piece of activity? I work for a very brand-focused business, but there can often be questions over direct ROI from the brand team versus the performance marketing team. Okay, James Edwards. This, James Edwards, is called the question. And as you're demonstrating, I get it in everything I ever do. A conference speech, a seminar, a class, a Q&A on the mini MBA, we get this question. And the question, paraphrasing it, James, it's asked beautifully here, but the question is always the same. I get the value of brand building. How do I explain to the Muppets who don't get it how to get it so I can go and do it? And I've been asked this question, I'm not exaggerating, 500 times. And for the first 200 or 300 times, I used to make up bullshit answers. And in the end, I got so frustrated with myself that I picked the six CMOs who I think are the best, who work for the biggest companies in the world, and who I know each went into that company when it was overspending on performance and underspending on brand, and increased the investment in brand to great success. And I asked them your question, and I said, how did you get the rest of the organization to get it? And they gave me the answers. And I wrote a column called The Question in Marketing Week, and then I use it for your question and everyone else's. So I will post a link to it on Monday. It's certainly also part of our readings later, but I'll not for the first time in the course, because it comes up every time, I will put a link to it. And rather than me answering your question, I'll let the CMOs answer it properly. It's a useful column, mate. Matt Evans, in the Moon case study, has any Sonai brand trademarked the phrase, why choose? No. Getting Matt in there early. Barb, interbrand calculations. How are brand impact and brand multiples calculated, and what are the factors used for these calculations? It's a bit of a trade secret, as you said, Barb. Have a look at the David Haig presentation to see. Julie, I'm really struggling with brand versus reputation. I found that some of the definitions in Module 1 were talking about reputation more than brand. Maybe I'm wrong. Could you help me get a clear distinction? It also does come up in a lot of conversations with stakeholders. They seem to care more about reputation than brand itself. They're the same thing, Julie. And it's not your fault that it's confusing. If you came out of the PR industries or PR-heavy industries, the focus on reputation that was built during the 90s and noughties has remained kind of there. Every other industry and background talks brand. But they mean effectively the same thing. I would encourage you not to worry about it. And if you're working in a service business, an agency, play out whatever definition the client uses, brand or reputation or whatever else, and know with confidence they mean the same thing, okay? You'll have some pedants who'll say to you, no, reputation is this and brand is that. I have a PhD. Most people would agree I'm one of the 10 experts in the world on this. I'm telling you they're the same, okay? For all intensive purposes. So just learn to switch it and have confidence that you're not missing something here. 9 times out of 10, people will use the B word, not the R word. I worked with a great guy once called Justin Bassini, and Justin was working for Deutsche Bank at the time. And I remember him saying to me, he was the head of brand, right? But he'd say, look, I work with all these German bankers. I say the B word and all the shutters come down and they run for the door. So he said, I've learned not to use the B word or the R word. He used whatever word was least offensive to the internal client. There's a lot of smartness there, right? We know what we're talking about. I would call it brand. It's certainly analogous to reputation. If they want to call it, the magical impact of perception, doesn't matter. Just have the confidence not to worry about it. Amy. Great first module. I don't know who's starting it. Everyone's very happy with module one. Easy to please, this group. This is good to know. I wonder whether it gets very, very good later on. If you like module one, you're going to be ecstatic by like module 8 or 9. I wonder whether you can use distribution as a measure of brand equity. E.g., if you're a retailer and the supplier chooses to give your brand exclusivity over other brands, I saw it noted as a benefit, but would this not also be the power of your brand? Not necessarily, Amy. So supply prices is also a very good way of doing this. If you look at a typical pricing thermometer, we don't cover that on this course, but in a typical pricing thermometer, one of the things to look for is the delta between your recommended resale price and the price that you sell it into a distributor or retailer as an enormous driver as well, irrespective of brand equity. If they can make more, I'll give you a good example. I used to work with a guy called Charles Gibbs. I'll be a little bit indiscreet. Sorry, Charles. Charles is now the CEO of Fevertree. He doesn't care. Charles used to be the CEO of Belvedere Vodka. And Charles and I in New York City went out and had an absolutely splendid afternoon. You know, if you're in Manhattan and you've got an afternoon free and one of your mates is the CEO of a large, really rather good vodka company, it's pretty hard for it to go wrong. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's contractually obliged to take you out and give you a hell of an afternoon. And I'm talking afternoon. I'm not talking evening. We didn't make it into the evening, right? I can remember smoking cigarettes on Fifth Avenue about 4 o'clock. No idea what was going on. It was fantastic. Anyway, Giles demonstrated right at the start how difficult his job was, right? Because he went, watch this. So we went into a bar that was a Belvedere account. We didn't let on he was the boss or anything, right? And we said, oh, yeah, a couple of martinis, a couple of vodka martinis. You've got the Belvedere here. Would you recommend that one? And the barman said, yes, yes, very good. But actually, off the menu, I've got a very special Polish vodka from, you know, Gdansk, where it's made by, you know, nubile men and women who have danced in the moon. I know some bullshit story in it. And he promptly said, so try this one instead. And Charles, while we're drinking these actually very good martinis, explained, this is my problem. I'm always going to have a, you know, even in my own contracted accounts, someone's going to slip in there with some artisan vodka and give them, you know, twice the profit for each martini that I give them. So there's no brand strength there. Hence my example for you, Amy. Amy, again, I also wondered about the brand resonance pyramid and how you see this model changing with the emerging Gen Z alpha consumers, where achieving brand resonance is looking trickier. It's not, Amy. It's not, and it's not your fault. So forget about Gen Z and alpha. That's the stuff that's made up by bad journalists, okay? There's lots of good data to demonstrate this. What would be, look, the Pew Center, right? So Pew Center, like, does all the great demographics in the US. Brilliant, but demographers, properly trained people, not marketers, right? The Pew Center now goes, basically, we're not using this Gen Z alpha bullshit because it's just horseshit. What's happening is, so are Gen Z people different from Gen X? Sure they are, because they're 15 years younger than them. I'm Gen X, right? Very just about scraped in Gen X, right? If I was 20 years younger, 25 years younger, I'd be super different, right? I'd be out there having sex, having dinner every night, randomly all over town. I'd be skeptical of this and not very materialist and all that. That's not a generational difference. It's the difference called being younger, right? So what we've done is invented this horseshit, which is a huge pile of horseshit, right? I'll put a column in. And Amy, I'm not having got your question. You are just a product of this, you know, bullshit attempt to say, oh, there's a new generation coming and they're much less committed to their job and all that. You know, if I said to you, black people prefer sport and Hispanic people prefer to eat, to drink more, you'd be like, that's a bit dodgy. It is dodgy, right? But I'm allowed to say, if you're born in like 1996, you do this, this, and this. If you're born in 1986, you do this, this, and this. There's nothing, it's still ageism and dodginess. So I'll put in, I've got a column called Demographics Are Horseshit. That's literally the title. Have a read of it, because I'm making that point. And I think it's an important point, right? Don't let them commit. Yes, there are young people and old people, they have different behaviors. The idea there's some tectonic shift coming, not true. According to Harvard, according to the Pew Center, according to anyone that's actually looked at it outside of, you know, Forbes magazine. And if you segment your market that way. Jane, hi Mark, I have a question to help me better understand the concept and effects of salience. Do you think the M&S Aldi Colin versus Cuthbert Caterpillar legal drama and subsequent free Cuthbert campaign by Aldi was damaging to Colin's brand image despite initial rise in sales due to publicity? Or is the brand protected by its image of being superior? No, they both won. They both won, Jane. So the point of salience is it's brutal, yeah? It has no flavor or color, yeah? If you're getting Colin and Cuthbert, which for those who are not in the UK, was a long stoush about, was it a cake? I forget now. But anyway, the M&S had a Colin first, was it? Yeah, M&S had Colin the Caterpillar cake, and then Aldi produced Cuthbert the Caterpillar cake and just ripped them off, as all they always do. And there was a big debate about this. I know, having not followed it, I know what happens anyway. Both brands win as a result, yeah? I tried years ago, when I worked at Melbourne University, I tried to get them to have a fight with Sydney University over who had the best MBA. And I fully intended to recruit Sydney University into the debate and just kick seven bells of shit out of each other in the media. Because what it would have done is essentially, in a market of 25 MBAs, like who's best, Melbourne or Sydney, Melbourne or Sydney, Melbourne or Sydney, we'd have just both won. But everyone was too conservative and stupid to get the point of what I was proposing, so we never did it. Yeah, salience is just good. It doesn't come with a positive or a negative thing, it's just good. There is such a thing as negative publicity. It's called negative publicity, and we can look at Bud Light as an example. You've got to go a very long way to get to the point where loads of salience still results in negative effects, much further than anyone really appreciates. So generally, it's always good news for everyone involved. Cody again, on the topic of when increased salience due to negative associations is still a net positive, well, here we go, to the brand. How do you determine that the negative association is not in contradiction to the core brand image and hence would be more likely to be a net positive? The Liquid Death brand came to mind here, which in many respects intentionally builds associations to negative things like death and many of their absurdist advertisements I see clearly help build brand salience. Yet it seems their strategy has been wildly successful. P.S. Loved hearing that you got it right on the coronavirus article and its impact to Corona's market share. I remember reading that column when it came out and wondering myself, but never saw the data to know one way or the other. Yeah, I've learned as a columnist that when you get it wrong, loads of people line up to remind you get it wrong. When you get it right, nobody brings it up. The guy was obvious. It's just obvious, right? You can't win. The answer, again, Cody, is positioning. So I'll give you two examples. We got, the Bud Light thing. Bud Light was drunk by a lot of older, more conservative, right-focused people, yeah? And so that transgressed. When they did the Dylan McDermott thing, they transgressed so far from that target and the positioning they wanted for their beer that it backfired. But it was, it was literally a 180, right? Gillette, when they did the toxic masculinity, again, had a very conservative, right-leaning, masculine, for want of a better word, user group. And so when they were told in this, they were terrible. It was a terrible ad. You're responsible for this. You guys should be ashamed of yourselves. It literally had to be that bad. But these are very rare exceptions where there was an impact on top line, bottom line. For the most part, the lesson, and we will get to this later in the course, is unless it runs directly against, in an obtuse and offensive way, your positioning or targeting, you need to loosen up and just go for it. Yeah. I've been doing, as you may have noticed, LinkedIn does these stupid, they're trying to train their AI engine. So they got all these stupid questions about, what do you do when your creativity is running dry, blah, blah, blah. Like questions that no one ever has, you know? So I've just been answering them for the last, week and a half with stupid answers about going down the pub. And that is, I'm angry that they're so boring, the questions. But it won't do me any harm at all. It's naughty and it's a bit stupid, but it'll be a general small net positive because I know how this works, right? Generally, it's, you're on safe turf here. The more, you can't have bad salience, right? Very, very, very hard. Harry Feng. Hey, Harry. Thanks for the awesome content. Definitely a life changer. Steady on, Harry. We're only in module one. By module 10, mate, you'll change everything then, right? The question I have is around brand commodification. You shared an example in the lecture where the Sun News commodifies luxury champagnes by revealing that Asda's 15 quid champagne is as good. So I think the article is clearly in Asda's favour, and I assume it got them a positive outcome. You bet. I wonder if there are any scenarios where a company would use commodification as a brand tactic to achieve a positive business outcome. Well, you've nailed it. Retailers. Retailers aren't mean. They don't want to destroy your brand, but they don't care either. And if they can say, look, I've discounted all of these way more, like Costco, I've discounted all these so much more than you could ever imagine, they're not being mean. It's just like, now we look great because we're cheaper than anyone else, but all the brands look shit and commodified. It's a classic retailer play. What's good for me is not good for you. Natalie, what's the recommended aim of brand awareness percentage within the target market that a brand should have in order to start building and creating long-lasting brand image? You don't know yet, Natalie. We will cover this in Module 7 when we do objectives. It'll depend on a few inputs. We'll absolutely cover it. Just get it in your head for now. We're going to come back to how you do it later. Module 1 and Module 2 are the least managerial of the modules. And now, once we've set these two things up, we're going to really get very sort of practical and managerial. Marcos, hi, Mark. Should the awareness metric include the non-penetrated market? That's interesting. I've seen a case of a brand with a much lower percentage of awareness than its market share, since it is not a commoditized category. These numbers would make sense only if the awareness metric included the non-penetrated target market. Am I right? Yeah, it's an interesting question, Marcos. Before you do your survey, you have to do your targeting. And the targeting question, even if you do mass marketing, which we'll talk about, you've still got to define the sophisticated mass market. It's very rarely everyone in the country. It can be if you're doing banking. But normally, if there's 50 million people in a country and you're selling dog food, you've still got to define, so who is the total market, penetrated or not, right? So that's the question you need to answer. Now, take penetration out of it. The question is, are they in my target, the mass, or not? And that question doesn't have a precise answer, but you need to have an answer in order to be able to handle it. Okay, time check. We are 51 minutes in. Oh, yeah, we're going to go long this week. We normally go long in the first one. I'll try and speed up a bit so we don't go too long. Alana. What's Alana saying? How much do economic factors impact the ability to set a price premium? Does a poor economy increase price sensitivity? For example, if people are struggling to pay their mortgages, will they choose Apple over other brands, or are they more likely to retain brand loyalty? It's super category dependent, Alana. And again, the brand has a big impact on it. But generally, yeah, price sensitivity can increase with economic woes and higher interest rates, but it isn't a consistent thing. You know, there's famous examples where people will trade down on these things in order to trade up on these things. So it depends, but it's certainly a factor. Victoria, how much does share of voice matter? Assume a large market leader brand with 30% market share, and if the media is planned that it reaches the maximum number of people, however, compromises on frequency, making its share of voice around 11 to 15% lesser, would this impact brand building? Yes. What is thus more important, reach or share of voice? What is the right share of voice to market share equation? That last bit depends, but there's very few laws and generic principles of marketing that I sign up to. But one of them is excess share of voice. It's been proved too many times. It's gravity, as far as I'm concerned. So if, you know, your first challenge is to get your share of voice to be at the right competitive level. In your example, if you've got 30% market share and your share of voice is 15%, you're going to lose market share over the next 10 years, whatever you do. Yeah. And the reverse is true. I get all, what I normally get is a CMO will say to me, this happens a lot, right? We've got 30% market share, but we want 40%. I'll ask, great, yeah, wonderful. What's your share of voice going to be? 25%. Doesn't matter. Yeah, you can cheat it a little bit with creativity and codification and things we'll talk about in the course, but not that much. It's gravity. So yeah, don't worry too much about reach and all that shit. Here's the proof point. Even Byron Sharp, the Dark Lord of Penetration, who hates any theory that wasn't invented by Ehrenberg Bass, he's got a paper basically saying begrudgingly, yeah, excess share of voice, yeah, it's true. It's gravity. You need to start with that. And it's a crucial factor, in my opinion. Victoria, in a commodity category example, toothbrushes. Now you get, there you go, Victoria, right? Commodity category. You've already basically gone, there's no room for brands here, right? You see my point? There's no such thing as a commodity category. There's a category with a lot of commodities in there, but it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, if you call it that. You carry on. If a competitor plays a pricing game and devalues the category and gains market share in the process, what is the recommended way of building the category, specifically if you're a market leader brand, to follow suit or build brand? It's definitely to build brand. It's definitely to go high. I mean, yeah, it's tricky because often dumb competitors can really hurt the whole category, themselves and you included. I've seen that play out. But if you follow, you'll get yourself in the toilet where everybody else is. The challenge is to maintain brand while at the same time showing the value that you have over the competitor. But don't go calling it commodity category, Victoria, because that tells me you're going to drop your pants, metaphorically, on price and follow these idiots down. When that happens, everybody loses except the consumer, right? So toothbrushes are not a commodity category. They're a category with a lot of commodities, but you guys are smarter than that. If you know your consumer, if you know your product is good, if you've got good innovation, it'll hurt your profitability, but look for promotions that aren't price-based. You know, maintain your premium. It's definitely doable, right? Heinz ketchup, man. Everyone else is gone now in the ketchup category because they've dropped their pants and discounted and blah, blah, blah. Heinz ketchup, man, just kept pushing salience, pushing what they stood for, maintaining excess share of voice. And what do you know? They're the king of the category. Victoria, what is the best methodology to identify a list of imagery attributes and associations that are exhaustive for next week? We're on to it next week. Victoria, again, a question to your slide, the why of branding. What's the best way to stay differentiated in low-volume categories like toothpaste, where consumers seek reduced search cost and familiarity? For instance, a case in example at my workplace, we created an enjoyable, familiar advertising campaign that drove spontaneous awareness for the brand. However, despite the brand losing market share, did not gain new tiers. The hypothesis was that the ad was not persuasive enough. We'll get there. We'll get there. It's a big question. We'll get there. And by the end of it, Victoria, you'll know what you missed out on. Victoria again, doing great work, Victoria. Is it important for an advertising to be persuasive? If so, how does one create that? Examples of market leaders who've built persuasive ads. We're not going to answer that one either. They're good questions, Victoria. You're asking me a question about comms. We'll get there. But comms isn't... The short answer to your question is being persuasive comes out of a strategy, yeah? Which is then executed into the ad. If you haven't done your strategy and you've jumped straight to advertising, it's not going to work. Stay with me on the process. You're asking me good questions, but it's too early. Do it one step at a time. I promise we'll get there. Willem, hi, Mark. In your first session, you talk about brand awareness, followed by brand associations. I understand that it's important to realize the activities focusing on the latter only makes sense when people are aware of the brand. However, what would be the effect of initiatives that tick both boxes at once? In other words, how impactful would introducing a yet unknown brand by showing what it stands for right away? One never has a chance to make a first impression twice. So wouldn't hide, this is what we do, here's what we stand for, be the preferred approach. Definitely, Willem, everything you do is going to be consistent with the position and build brand associations, including the awareness work. But once you have awareness, you're not thinking it through. So, okay, you create awareness. You've still got to keep doing the other stuff without saying, hi, I'm new. Do you see what I mean? So the answer is, yeah, consistent to the brand image when you introduce yourself and then forever after. So yeah, the short answer is yes, both. Vivek, dear Mark, on the topic of brand versus commodity, it happens often that a brand eventually falls into danger of becoming a commodity due to external factors like launch of more or less similar but cheaper competitive products, growing choices, etc. When that happens, certain segments start to drift towards cheaper alternatives. As a brand manager, what would be your recommendation to manage that customer segment? Look, it happens a lot, right, in the marketplace. I did a study on it, on what happens when the category becomes commodified, and as you say, some segments drift. I'll post it as a follow-up on Monday. Because, again, I looked at whatever the Crisp brand was and Dell and how they managed it. Let me send you the article. Tess, when implementing metrics around brand recognition, recall, top of mind, and salience... What would you suggest is a certain level of investment into research and insights, which is in relation to marketing spend? Well, sort of. It comes up in the moon case, right? When I was setting the moon case, I talked to a few of my CMO mates and I said, how much money, you know, you've got $500,000 marketing budget, right? But that's got to go research, agencies, and media, yeah? So I said to them, how much would you... When do you get worried that a brand manager is spending too much? And the general threshold was if they spent more than 30% of their budget in year one on research, you'd have to have a look at it, right? So in your world, that's about 150,000, you know, 180,000 bucks. Having said that, if you can do it for less, it obviously leaves you more room later. And it also means that's in year one. When you do that initial deep dive diagnosis, you don't have to keep spending that amount of money later. So let's say 30% is the threshold in year one. Then it should come down. I always say 5% is the minimum. 10% is the sweet spot in an annual piece of diagnosis, all things being equal. Marie-Anne, do you have any tips to share for advocating for brand health over performance marketing? This is the question. As budgets become tighter, I find myself constantly having to justify. Okay, Marie-Anne, it's the question. Hang on, she's added more at the bottom though. From your perspective, what role does brand play in feeding other marketing campaigns, familiarity, etc.? Okay, so Marie-Anne, first thing is I'm going to publish the question as a follow-up. You'll get the answers from good CMOs. And then adding here, what role does brand play in feeding other marketing campaigns? Yeah, it's super important. We will talk about it later, right? I don't want to get too much into campaigns yet, but having the long of it play out across your advertising is very important, as we will see. Philippine, great first module. Excited about the next modules. You mentioned in module one that communicating meanings of what we stand for is branding, and contradictions such as run sales, promotions, commodified, destroys brand. If you're working as a brand manager or a brand that has a very high promotion pressure, greater than 80%, how can you still build or strengthen a brand if you didn't have a lot of innovations, just a huge focus on the core SKU? Yeah, well, I'm publishing the what's called IMG FUCK, which is the story of how companies have got away from 60, 70, 80% emphasis on promotions. It's tricky, but it's possible. Have a look at that, Philippine, when we get to it. Marion. Hey, Marion. I'm interested in the idea of only writing a brand plan for the next 1 year rather than the next 3 years. Should the strategy ideally stay the same in future years, but perhaps with a change in tactics? And if some tactics require briefing agencies and developing campaigns, which process could take over a year? How does that work? Yeah, look, I'm speaking from experience, Marion. Three-year plans, five-year plans have a place in companies in other areas, but marketing is an annual pursuit, in my opinion. Things move too much. And year two, year three just become extrapolations in those plans. So having said that, it doesn't mean that I'm suggesting that every year it completely changes. I think you can have a long-term view. When you do the simulation for Moon at the end of the course, you've got 5 years to manage the brand. I would have a tentative five-year plan in mind, but then lay it out 1 year at a time and course correct. If you're doing multiple things with agencies, it's the same thing. You just brief them for the year with the objectives for the next year, with the understanding that then you'll pick it up a year later and extend it and so on. You know, new product development tends to be a three-year, five-year thing. But again, you can have that kind of separate idea and then bring it into, but my plan is about what we're going to do next year. It's not that hard. It's not that hard. I'm not saying you don't think long-term, but I'm saying that your specific plan is only for the next 12 months, and then you'll pick up after seeing what happens in that next 12 months. It works great. It works great. Annalise, very much enjoying the course. Let's say you're building your brand plan. You discover in the diagnosis that you've been historically targeting a segment of the market in which your product doesn't necessarily meet their needs. And for this brand, there is only one product. But the product development lies with a completely different team outside of marketing. And whilst you have the ability to advise, you don't have authority. In the brand diagnosis section, as the brand manager, I'm trying to work out how to convey this discovery, as the product itself is outside my scope. How do you handle this? Do you give a series of options, i.e. the primary target market that they've historically served is more viable? I suppose I'm asking how you handle these situations in which you perhaps find misalignment in the product service and the traditional target markets the company served and the stakeholders above you that are involved. It's a great discovery, Annalise. Congratulations. You don't have power, but you have influence. What you need to do is use your data rhetorically to play this out. I wouldn't even go as far as suggesting strategy. I would just go back and say, we have a problem because right now this target does not like this product that we're offering, and here's the data, okay? And what I recommend we do is consider our options and then start to debate this and everything else. That's all you can do, Annalise. But just because it's not under your control doesn't mean it's not brilliant you found this out, or that you shouldn't now make a massive point to stakeholders of the problem. you know, it depends how good your bosses are. Yeah, it's got, you're obviously very good. If your bosses are idiots, and they often are, they're going to go, what are you talking about? That's stupid, right? But if they're good and they're curious and they're market-oriented and they're proper marketers, they'll look at your data and ask to talk to you about it. And that's all you can do. It's off your desk then, and you've made the point. And at that point, you've done everything you can do. Chris, can a commodity be turned back into a brand? Yes, if the market has already been inherently commoditized around price and need. Yeah, it can. I mean, it's tricky, and again, I'm one of my follow-ups is about getting out of the commodity toilet. It's very, very tricky, but it's possible. Have a look at the follow-up stuff. Chris, in the HBR article, it mentions brands are used as identity markers. Do you think there's any shift in that, as the importance people place on brands today as identity marketers, especially among Gen Z, how they use brands these days with the proliferation of challenger products to strong existing brands? It's exactly the same mechanism, Chris. The brands and consumers have changed. The mechanism is the same. Chris, if brands can be valued, if brands can't be valued unless conceptually, how do you know if you're overpaying for a brand when taking over a business? Is there always this measure of risk that you assume the value of what consumers think of your brand? No. And can this make brands invaluable? No, let's be clear. When you hire an external valuation firm like Interbrand or Brand Finance, what they're doing is putting an actual book value on the brand. Now, it's still a perspective, it's still a valuation, it's subject to the buyer's desire, but it's a hard financial valuation that comes certified from the valuation company. Yeah, it's an estimate, but it's an estimate based on data. And in that sense, it's like buying a house, right? Some people want the house more than others, but there's a valuation that the real estate agent has put on it, which is relatively accurate. Number four, when creating a brand plan, what are the top three pieces of research to invest in? Next week, module three. Chris, I found the readings and podcasts interesting. I understand there are no channel strategies and just a brand strategy. However, if your business believes that you do develop strategies for different marketing channels, what would your approach be here? I just wouldn't buy into that, Chris. I think the minute you have multiplicities of strategies, it's all going to go horribly wrong. There's a brand strategy that aligns with the overall corporate strategy, and that strategy then drives the execution. But what you're describing is tactification, is tactics kind of demanding their own strategies. And it's going to go, trust me, it's going to go horribly wrong. The cart is pulling the horse. As we go through the course, you'll see how to do it. We need a strategy for our brand, and then we need to execute it in comms and other things. Never forget, advertising is 8% of brand management. Yeah, this is not advertising management. Advertising is a relatively weak touch point. It's not that important. And as a brand manager, you've got loads more stuff on top of comms to work on, and it needs a central holistic strategy. Because if you start having different strategies for different channels, it's a mess. And then they don't align with the price and the distribution and everything else that should also be aligned to a same core strategy. Don't go down that path. Trust me, it's chaos. Chaos. If you have a Facebook strategy, and then you have above-the-line strategy, and then you've got a TikTok strategy, it's not going to work. Victoria, in the article on coronavirus won't hurt Corona, you speak of the brand GIF, which improves on salience, but not on image with its campaign. Isn't brand image a subset of salience? No. Brand image is nothing but a set of associations, and salience goes up, brand image should too. What is the difference? So, salience is a cognitive variable. It's a presence or not. When I think about cleaning my bathroom, does the brand come to mind? Yes or no? Yeah. When we get to image, what we're talking about, the perception of the brands that do come to mind. So this is a second step. And now it's a case of, and do I perceive it to be X, Y, or Z? Yeah. So they're linked together holistically. It's not like it happens with two bullet points in the brain. But salience or awareness is about whether it exists. Image is about the perception then, and the strength of perceptions if it exists. Victoria, in the coronavirus one hurt Corona, you speak... Oh, we did that one, sorry. Jenny, really enjoying the course. A bit of context. I work for a B2B2C services business where white labeling at point of sale is a strategic choice with a significant history and validated by recent comms research. Good. As we navigate entering competitive new markets, it's crucial to prioritize building our partner brand, not only to attract new clients, but also to emphasize the value of our brand in potentially new ways. This emphasis could be through driving dual-branded customer experiences, taking a more product-led approach, but ultimately it's about enhancing our brand awareness in both new and existing markets for partners and customers alike. Considering the complexities of brand equity in this model, how does it differ from traditional customer-facing brands? And what unique factors contribute to its development and assessment? I'm going to give you an easy answer, Jen. I don't think it changes at all, at all. I think the basics are still absolutely applicable, and I wouldn't look for any differences. It's very common when you sit in one particular place and you go, well, how is this different for my situation? I think B2B, B2C are fundamentally the same. I mean, they're not, but when people go, you know, in B2B, it's a bit different, or in your case, in B2B, B2C, we've got to do this, it's a bit different from B2C, as if B2C is the same. B2C could be selling wart cream, a car, the cinema, a handbag, you know what I mean, a trip to Paris. They're all different too. So I don't think there are any major differences as long as you're picking up from diagnosis to strategy the specificities of your challenge. Meredith, from Module One, I'm curious if you would place callouts like sustainably made or small business in the perceived quality category or the meaning category. It could be either, Meredith. It's an interesting point, right? It could be either or both, unfortunately. Andrew, you mentioned the fastest way to commodify a brand is run promotions. When you think of an online marketplace like Amazon running large-scale promotions for Prime Day, what's your view on the impact this has on the Amazon parent brand specifically? Any negative or positive impact? Look, it's separate. It's positive for Amazon because it's not their brand that they're usually selling. It's a supplier's brand. So on Prime Day, if we run something 50% off, Amazon doesn't damage its brand at all. It definitely helps its brand. It's the retailer. Retailers get benefit from selling a special offer. They build their brand. It's the brand that is being sold that gets the damage in this case. Rob, I'm not sure whether now is the right time to ask this about the Moon case study, but I have a few. If it's better to wait, please ignore. Okay. What was the nature of the Max Moon scandal in 1970 that saw him lose his research position at MIT? It was a gay affair. And it's mentioned somewhere, you've got to buy the research. Do we have prices and feature specs for competitor Serenite brands? Yes. Can we get them somehow? Yes. You might have to pay for it. Do we need to think about anything outside whatever country we're in? Geographic expansion, competitive sets? No, that, don't worry about that. It's all going to happen within this single country, okay? Andrew Smith, if you were a consultant in the boardroom with Zuckerberg when Facebook was rebranding to Meta, or Elon decided to change Twitter to X, what recommendation or implications would you share? Would you have changed anything in hindsight? Look, I mean, I think the Twitter to X is an easier one. I mean, he wouldn't have listened to anyone. I mean, that's one of his problems. I still admire Elon, but I don't think he's listening to anyone. But the point about Twitter to X is Twitter was worth about $5 billion. That was its stated brand equity, which, if you look at its profit, was a significant amount of money. Ripping that up didn't make any sense to me at all. The Facebook move, rebranding to Meta, less stupid, still quite stupid, just purely because... look, less stupid, though. Less stupid. No, still quite stupid. Good idea. Brand architecture quite good, but the name obviously is going to come back to haunt them as time moves on and away from the metaverse. I'm on record talking about both when they happened with a column, and I was very clear that both were stupid, and I'm also very clear that no one was going to listen to me. Philippine, thank you for the great first module. I have a question about brand equity. Our research partner does not report on brand equity, but claims that the meaning of the brand... associations such as inspiring, cool, traditional, and awareness is in fact the brand equity. Is that a correct way to measure brand equity? Yeah, it can be. I mean, you need a measure of awareness and then a measure of all the associations. We'll talk about it more next week. Chloe, do you think that discounters are a risk to brands? Yeah. Data tells us that consumers who shop in grocers and discounters are becoming blurred. Consumers are not as loyal and cross-shop a lot more. With more and more brands moving into discounters, what do you think makes a brand successful in that space? And how are they able to maintain their premium position without being counterintuitive to the perceived difference, price premium expectation? And Chloe says, reading the Harvard Business Review is knowing the core associations of the brand the key to successful long-term positioning. Yeah, look, it's unavoidable, Chloe, that you go into these discounters. The key thing is you go into it with a clear strategy, and you're still building your brand outside of that discounter, maybe with increased promotion. I've worked for large premium brands that have been more and more sold through discounts. One of their reactions is, we still make a lot of money from these guys. We have to invest more in building our brand outside to the consumer so we offset the damage. So yeah, it's good. It's even better brand management. Chloe, again, read the brand report card. It discusses where a portfolio has more than one brand and overlapping them can be dangerous. Where portfolios have done this and ultimately one brand is succeeding and one isn't, would you recommend focusing on the categories that are successful and allowing the declining part of the portfolio to drop away? We'll cover it in brand architecture, Chloe. It's a complex, great question. Needs a complex answer. Chase Carpenter. That's a great name, Chase. Thanks so much, Juan. For teams working with limited budgets, how would you recommend ongoing tracking of recognition, recall, and top of mind? I hear teams say frequently, we're doing display advertising, so we have some awareness out there, which is a wholly inadequate representation. Also, what are some simple measures of brand equity that particularly appeal to non-marketer C-suites? Some context, I work frequently with executives who think that branding and brand spend is a waste of resources. Yeah, Chase, you'll like some of the follow-ups. Have a look at Tracksuit. They're a New Zealand firm and they do amazing brand tracking for very little money. Small firms can afford it. And have a look at share of search. We'll cover it later in the course, but share of search is a very good proxy measure for brand, in my opinion. Could give you some help there too. Max, hi Mark, the most important rule of branding and advertising is first they must know that it's me. I agree with that. And the second most important rule is to remind them that they still need to know it's me. I agree with that too. What would you say is the third rule? Make them remember me? Make them like me? Make me stand out? No, Max, they still need to know that it's you because they've already forgotten it. They've already forgotten it. So all three times, they need to know that it's you. That's where you spend your bullets. It's a bullshit statistic. 70%, 80% of all of your challenges is just to maintain salience. You know, 95% of your customers are not in the market right now. So what are you doing with them? You're keeping salience. So when they come into the market, boom. You know, in my world of mini MBA, I don't think at all about the people who are considering the course. I think about all the other marketers out there that haven't yet been promoted or fired or gone on maternity leave or all the other category entry points, and about how I just keep the course there so that when that shit happens, they'll come to me, right? So they just got to keep knowing it's you. It's 1, 2, and 3. Amy, hi Mark. Of the 1,000 brand plans you've seen, what were the real standout plans and what made them great? That's a great question, Amy. I like Amy, that's question of the week. Just because it's so awesome. Amy Morrison. What's my answer? It's a different question. You'll get like $200 of like, I don't know, Tupperware or something, Amy. There was a guy called Nick Hagen who used to run biosurgery for a company called Baxter. He's now, I think he runs Novartis in Bulgaria now. He's a great guy. And Hagen was known as the mailman, which there's a famous, if you all know this, Amy. But in the 1990s, there was a great basketball player who played for Utah called Karl Malone. And Karl Malone's nickname was the mailman. And his nickname was the mailman because he used to work in the post office. That's not true. His nickname was the mailman because he always friggin' delivered. Yeah? With 3 minutes to go, give it to the mailman. Right? And Nick was our mailman in the sense that he did the best brand plans. They were beautiful. But the thing that made them particularly impressive to my MD and my CMO were the ones that really choose. Technically, they were very good. But what did my MD and what did my CMO think about Nick's plan? What they liked about Nick's plan was whatever Nick said on that final slide in terms of, if you give me $2 million, I'll give you $10 million incremental back next year. He always delivered. He was the mailman. So every year, we must have done this for nearly 10 years. Nick would turn up with his brand plan. And David, my GM, would turn around and go, we can enjoy it. He's going to get his money. And if I have to take money off other ship brand managers, I'll just take it off them because I know if I give him 2, I'll get 10. And there were times where he asked for way more than we were expecting, and he got it. His brand plan was good. But the main thing, and we will talk more about brand plans as we go through, but the main thing was he had a reputation for always delivering on his number. And I think marketers don't get that, right? It's only when you work interfunctionally with companies you realize the importance of the number has to be impressive, and then you gotta deliver it. You cannot miss out, right? And that's what makes for a great brand plan. And all that, all, and again, we'll talk about this much later in the course. If you look at the attention of the important people, the CFO, the managing director, the CMO, they don't give a toss about the first 16 slides on research and segmentation. When you get the budget, the bit that most marketers don't really spend any time on, it's all about that. And that's what makes a good brand plan. You got to give me help here, Mac. Mac. I hope you're not going to shout at me for calling you Mac. If brand salience is a propensity of a brand to be noticed in buying situations, can we talk about high brand salience without brand awareness? E.g., I see a very distinctive brand that has just been launched, but I don't know before in a point of sale that I did not know before in a point of sale, and I decided to buy it. Yeah. Ooh, Mac, that's almost good enough to displace Amy. Yeah, absolutely right. There's two routes to salience. Yeah, the first route we talked about earlier, category entry points. And when you think about promotion, I need to get trained, you think about mini MBA. The other route is at point of sale, you look like yourself and you look distinctive, and therefore you stand out and people go, this is a good book. Oh, and you buy you. And that could have no preceding awareness. So yeah, you're absolutely right. If you've got distinctive packaging, which is codified, we'll talk about that in the course. Katrine, I do have a couple of questions. Tactification. In reality, bigger companies have PR, campaign, or social media teams that all have their own objectives and strategy. But in the end, these are the teams the brand team needs for the tactical execution. So if tactics are a part of brand management, how can this work together with other teams that actually are on the tactical side? Briefing, Katrine. We'll get into it. Briefing is where you explain to these teams who do work for you downstream, these are my strategic objectives related to targeting and positioning and the actual objectives. Now, on the basis of that, you can now generate your what I would call tactical goals. That's great, but they're all serving this master here. They're not in parallel. That would be tactification. Number two, positioning. I was quite confused about the part with positioning per target audience. Does it mean I can position myself as a premium brand for one and a cost-efficient one for others? How can this work? Well, you could do that, but it would be, as you point out, stupid, yeah? So there's a couple of ways to get around this. We're going to talk about it a lot more. We haven't covered targeting or positioning yet, right? I believe the best approach is what I call two-speed. I believe it's now clear that to build a brand, if you have the budget, you should target everyone in the category. But I also believe that when you run performance or activation or short-term stuff, you can then target specific groups. So what we're going to look at, not now, but as the course progresses, is the idea of a two-speed approach. Meaning, and I'll give you lots of examples, I'm going to target the whole market with my brand, but in order to get someone to go out and buy it, who might be different from a different segment, I may activate different messages at that product level. We'll explain. But obviously, no, it's not like to these guys were high-end and these guys were low-end. That would be dumb. It's all got to be contiguous with the overall brand, but we'll get to it. Hold fire. Let's just get through diagnosis. Then we'll do targeting in module 4, and you'll start to see that avenue of long and short opening up. It definitely is. Not only can it work, it's been working really well for a couple of large clients. We'll talk about it. Brand management and PR. PR and marketing teams are usually quite separated in most companies, but in times of decreasing marketing spend, they can play an active role in shaping the brand at lower costs. How should these two different teams, within the end, different audiences, media versus customers, work together? As the brand manager in the center of things, Katrine, you're running that, right? It's not media versus customers, yeah? It's media and then ultimately getting to customers and with brand manager at the top, yeah? The PR agency is working again for you as the brand manager. That's the corporate strategy. The PR agencies are very important, as you say, managing the media, which is still ultimately about customers. Don't allow the communication agencies to argue for a different approach because they're doing something over here. They're aligned with your overall strategy. They work for the overall brand strategy. Otherwise, it's chaos. Jane Clark. Great first two modules. I'm just thinking back to brand and brand equity and also brand diagnosis in the brand plan. As part of your diagnosis, would you also not look at what your brand stands for and its role within the category you play, but also that of your main competitors and what they stand for and how they differentiate themselves in the market? This could add, also lead into targeting. Yeah, so we'll get onto it next week, Jane. You're going to be disappointed. I'm not a big fan of studying competitors too much. I like to get my competitor information through the lens of the customers and how they perceive us and them. I'm not a big fan of looking at what is the strategy of my competitors in my eyes. That's a criticism of my work sometimes, but I find that's the right way to do it. Let's go through next week and then you can see. Laura, I'm really enjoying the first two modules. With the Moon case study, can you confirm that the 1% of the research sample that they've said they will buy a Sonite is 1% of the 49%? Many thanks. It's 1% of the 100%. Carmen, how do you work with share of voice, share of market ratio when you aim also at sophisticated mass marketing? How do you define the proper perimeter category to calculate your share of voice? That's a good question too. So with sophisticated mass marketing, it doesn't really influence this. The question is still, you could do it that way. You could. I like this question a lot. I get where you come from, Carmen. I get where you're coming from. The short fix would be, if I've already got my sophisticated mass market and my, I don't know, three or four main category entry points, can I list the brands that come up there with high levels of salience, and can I import that across to the share of voice calculations? I like complicated stuff, but not too hard. Good question. Laura, I'm really enjoying all the reading and already applying it to my day. Do you believe all the thinking is as relevant for B2B and B2C? Yes, Laura, and just for you, I'm going to publish on Monday my article, which talks about why you're brilliant and this question is great, but it's also a stupid question when you think about it, and I'm going to explain why. But yes is the answer. I'm going to cough. Time-wise, we're well over. I'm sorry about this. Carmen, considering saliency as per definition of Sharp and Romanyuk as the first step in building brand equity, how do we approach its measurement versus the standard approach of measuring awareness, recall, and recognition? Your example refers still to the classical approach that cues the product category only. Yeah, I'm not an Ehrenberg Bassian, Carmen. We talked about it earlier in the Q&A, how you would go about category entry points and then measuring salience. Barb, as a brand manager, what is the best way to get information for my marketing team about the target audience if they're not inherently part of the target audience? That one's going to haunt me, Barb. What is the best way to get information for my marketing team about the target audience if they are not inherently part of the target audience? I think the answer is do consumer research. Let's pick it up next week. It's a tautological question. Carmen, how do you adapt the presented brand plan regarding the tactics when in most companies you have a two-step approach? First, get your strategy approved by the management and then start briefing the external partner agencies to define the tactics. Well, yeah, that it sometimes works that way. The issue is when the money comes in, yeah? I would say to you, and we will talk about it a bit more, but I would say to you, doing that early enough to get approval, to then go back and then brief agencies and get budget approval is one option. The other option is include a preliminary tactical investment subject to approval, which also includes a budget proposal as well. I'd prefer that approach, right? So you say to your agencies, we're not doing this yet, but if let's work on a proposal, and if I get approval, we will be doing it. It's probably the superior approach. Cody, just finished module 2. I can appreciate the benefits of the brand plan being annual, but have you ever seen value in quarterizing it? Perhaps with younger brands, especially given quarterly board meetings? If not with diagnosis and strategy, how valuable are quarterly or tactical milestones? Yeah, that's different, Cody. I mean, I think we're talking about the overall plan being annual. If you, like retail does this, right? Retail will have some quarterly executions going on. I think at the tactical level, it can break down into smaller increments. But the overall plan, the best time frame is annual. Shiv, for non-marketers like a CFO of a bank, how would you empirically show and quantify the ROI of bank building? This also is the question, Shiv. It'll be in the follow-up material. Oh, also brand salience, how do you measure this? We talked about it up there. I'll try. The problem is Ehrenberg Bass don't share their trademark methodology very well. A lot of you are asking about measuring salience, so I'll try and find something. If I can, I'll post it. Meredith Jensen. Hey, Meredith. You've encouraged us to avoid using frameworks, SWOT, PEST, etc. Oh, yeah. And while I've always been dubious about their value, most of us work in industries where such methodologies are sacrosanct. Yeah. I've spent the past decade in the professional services, consulting, advisory space where deploying these acronym-laced methodologies for different clients are not only table stakes, but expected. Yeah, yeah. Look, if a client wants these stupid things, Meredith, you got to do it. I've done a SWOT in the last 12 months because a client wanted to do a SWOT. I'm not going to say you're stupid. If a client wants to pay me a very large amount of money to spend a day with the team writing pointless stuff in a 2x2, I'm your man. But if I'm asked, do you think SWOT is worthwhile? I'm going to do client leadership and explain to them exactly what you think. It's all pointless, right? Anyway, carry on. What guidance can you offer on how to persuade stakeholders their proven business school tools need to be tossed out? There are big egos in the C-suite. No one wants to be told what they've been doing for years is rubbish. Would love to hear some examples where you've advocated for new ways of developing strategic plans and made them pivot. Yeah, look, first of all, I'm not going to tell a client, the C-suite client especially, don't do SWOT if they want to do SWOT. I'm going to go, let's do a SWOT. Awesome. PEST. Yeah. Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Thumbs up. You know, I work for them, not the other way around. I'm going to always propose a brand plan that looks a lot like the brand plan you're going to work on for Moon and we're going to build over the weeks. And at some point, they're going to say to me, there's no SWOT. And I'm going to go, yeah, I find SWOT to be totally pointless. But if you want to do SWOT, we can absolutely do it. That's the key, you know. Client leadership is a really interesting... I tell you, years ago, I used to train McKinsey consultants. And I was there to do like marketing. And there was an old guy called Peter something. He was a McKinsey guy with like 25 years experience. And he did the morning, and then I took over the afternoon. And we'd do it in Miami and Kitzbühel and everywhere. And I used to sit in on his session because I was going next. But also, he was always great, you know. And he taught them client leadership. And the whole point of the session was, look, say to a client, if there's an appropriate point, this is stupid. But also, if you want to do it, I'm right there. I'm so committed, I'll do it. But it's stupid, and you'll find later it's stupid. And the best outcome is the client does it and discovers it's stupid later. But you do it with them because you love them and you're dedicated. And that's such a beautiful concept. So I'm not, you know, that arrogant that I would go in and say to them, don't do SWOT, it's stupid, right? If someone asks me, I'm going to say, I find SWOT, PEST, and Maslow's... I'm being honest with you guys because I'm your professor, right? If I'm in a setting with a client and the client says, I always need a SWOT, I'm going to go, righto. And I think that's the flex you always need, Meredith. And there's no shame in you doing a SWOT because the client wants it, right? We've both done worse than that because the client wants it. Malika. Hi, Mark. Absolutely loving how and what you are sharing with us. Great. I have a couple of questions. Market research. What is the best way to measure small brands? Okay, we're going to do it next week. I'm also going to publish the small marketing tool where we look at smaller brands with smaller budgets as a follow-up on Monday. Brand awareness. I know it varies from industry to industry, but is there a guideline on the brand awareness to achieve? No. It's all, we're going to cover that in module 3 and then in objective setting. There's no kind of external benchmark. 3, financial brand equity. How do you attribute sales to a brand? Which measuring methodology gives you this answer? That's pretty simple. Any company can estimate what the revenues are per brand in the portfolio. It's not that hard. It's the other two questions that need a little bit more work. Brand management. Looking to learn the best-in-class brand management. Not only skills, but also from an organizational point of view. Can you share with us the absolute necessary and optimal collab working process of a brand manager, brand lead? Like to put it in practice? I've been to places where it's a mess. Brand manager is a performance marketer. Yeah, we'll get there. Give it time. We're going to show you some examples as we go. 5, brand plan. If talking about big global brands, how many people are leading the creation of the global brand plan, and what are the titles and responsibilities? It varies, you know, by company by company. Typically, the global brand plan is done by the central marketing team in New York or London or Chicago, and then each country has a per brand has a brand manager working on the local part of it. But normally the brand plan is developed by the global brand manager, VP of branding, whoever that might be. 6, brand plan objectives. If choosing to have more than one objective, what's the right balance? Wait, we're going to have a whole module on this. Wait. How are we going here? Ashita, I have questions about the diagnosis. How can small companies analyze the market without access to extensive research reports? We'll cover it next week, Ashita, but I'm also going to post on Monday small marketing, which gives you some answers. Number two, in high-stakes B2B brand management, how can we effectively gauge customer perceptions when clients are reluctant to introduce us to their niche markets? You can do a survey. Again, AI, I'm working with a company that's particularly in B2B, is producing remarkable B2B synthetic data that gets over this very quickly. So the answer is coming. Tina, service brand versus protagonist brand. When building a brand in the knowledge education field, how to balance or distinguish the product versus the founder, e.g. mini MBA and you. What's Mark Ritson to the mini MBA? Brand architecture, Tina, we'll get to it. When we launched it, we launched it under the auspices of Marketing Week because we were worried it wasn't stated enough. Sorry. But now we're sort of more confident that it's me and the thing. But of course, at some point, I want to retire, not for a long time, I hope. And so again, we kind of give ourselves a bit of distance, but it's a brand architecture question. James Edwards, I'm loving the mini MBA. In module two, we talk about how one of the best advantages of a strong brand is the ability to extend into new markets. A few questions. Is there an optimal process for assessing the best opportunities for brand extension? In terms of making decisions about brand extension, at what point do you accept it's a total macro level demand issue? Okay, module eight, brand architecture. We'll go in there, James. We'll go in there. Just hold your horses. Matthew Hall, in cases where a brand's image doesn't match up with its identity, what's a logical framework to evaluate whether to stay the course or change tack? Positioning, we're going to cover it. Svitlana, good evening and thank you for the well-balanced and evolving content. Thank you, Svitlana. My questions, in the era of obsession with Byron Sharp and the building salience and distribution, what is the most effective way to lead conversations about brand equity and differentiation building with top management, especially with the global marketing team? I did a talk, Svitlana, which was about differentiation and how I think Byron and his gang have got it half right and half wrong. That's probably the best critique, and I'll post a link to it. I get pretty stuck into them, and they still haven't responded, which suggests I'm probably all right there. You mentioned that it's recommended to show ROI in a brand plan. The challenge is that it's usually short-term annual ROI. Is there some cumulative effect to build salience and brand equity for bigger brands? And if we suddenly stop doing anything with a big brand, its financial performance may not suffer much. However, longer term it may. Do you recommend the longer term ROI methodology? We'll get to it in module 10 budgeting. Great questions. We will answer them. Not yet. Deborah, when companies buy brands, how can you justify a rebrand of the CFO when the purchase brand is on the balance sheet, but not the brand you would be rebranding to? When AT&T bought, what was it called? Signify or something? They paid $2 billion. A billion of it was brand equity. Within a year, they'd shut it down, Signify, whatever the hell it was called, and moved everyone to AT&T Mobile. Why? It cost about $500 million a year to properly advertise a mobile phone brand. So their argument was within 2 or 3 years, we'll actually be ahead. That's why they do it. And finally, Amanda John. I'm thrilled to be doing your mini MBA. I'm thrilled you're here, Amanda. My question relates to module one, where you reference Interbrand's top 100 and how they calculate financial brand equity. The company I work for currently tracks the sales of our brands, and they're now looking to brand equity in their brand equity. I'm keen to understand how to calculate the brand impact and brand multiple. You can't, Amanda. You're measuring your own children's attractiveness. You need to hire one of the three valuation firms to give you their methodology and their external audited assessment. I would recommend of the three Brand Finance. They're the cheapest and most flexible. All right, well done. Amazing questions. We did an hour of 40 minutes. So, many of you are asking about it, so let's get on. We move now to research and brand diagnosis. It's a huge module, but really good. Enjoy it. And then the week after, we'll do targeting, which again will answer a lot of your questions. And we'll do long and short then as well. Keep looking at the moon plan. Just chip away at it. It's definitely worth it. Keep just getting into the weekly cadence now. Remember, I'm on LinkedIn if there's anything interesting you want to pull out. But I'll see you in 2 weeks' time for another Q&A. And now we're starting to move. Have a fun 2 weeks. I'll see you for our next Q&A in a couple of weeks.